June 7th, 2021. Today was the 27th of Sivan earlier, or well, sort of the Shkia now. And it is class number 51. We are continuing in the appendix. We might finish it today, and then I have one more after that. If not, I'm not going to push it. If we have to go one more class, that's okay. We did very interesting things last time. Let me show you something here. Let me get my screen here. We spoke about the lost train. And we have someone listening to us now who was on the lost train. We heard about Rabbi Pollack. You can just Google this and you can read all about it. It was lost because they didn't know where it was, but it's not like it disappeared at the end of the war. And the story of the Emmanuel story, which you can read all about how there was someone on the train who kept track of all the people who died on the train and where they were, you know, just pushed off the train or buried at various stops. So you can read all about that. Just another of the fascinating stories from the war, distressing stories that you can read about. I also mentioned the Stolperstein of Rabbi Weinberg. The Stolpersteins are these things that look like this that you see all over. You see them in Germany, you see them in Italy, you see them in all over Europe, many countries. You don't see them in Munich, by the way, because one of the machers in Munich, this woman, is a survivor, and she was always opposed to it. She says she doesn't like it. She thinks it's disrespectful, but you find this all over Europe where Jews, it used to be where people lived. You see this in Hungary as well, where they were deported and were killed. They opened it up a couple of years ago to even survivors that you pay for it. It's like $150. Here's a picture, by the way, of the man putting it in Berlin. It's a business. He makes a living from it. Nothing wrong with that. Everyone deserves to make a living. This was put in, as I said, in Berlin. I think it was around March or April, I should say. And I think it was in 2019. Well, let me enlarge it so you can see it. Oops. It says, here lived Yechiel Jacob Weinberg, rabbi. He went to in March of 39 to Poland, and he was arrested in 1941 in the Polish occupied territory. And he was freed. That's where he was, the war, Wolfsburg, Weissenberg. It was a prisoner of war camp for Russian officers, and that's where he was. Why he was there is an interesting story. And so here they put down, you can see some flowers there. And lo and behold, the craziest thing, there's a rabbi in Berlin named Jonas Sievers, and he happened to be walking, he lives right near there, he happened to be walking by, and he saw it as they were putting it down. And I hadn't told him about it, but we were supposed to have, as I said, in the summer, we'll have, God willing, we will have a dedication, and we'll speak about that. Let's see. I'll get to this. By the way, is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach with Yonah Emanuel, the one we'll be speaking about later, a little later today as well. A couple more things I want to tell you. In Rabbi Mazuz's Parsha sheet, we haven't heard about Rabbi Mazuz in a few weeks, but he still publishes it every week. Number 263, he says something that reminded me very much of what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. This is in page 4. He's speaking about the Gaonim, and he says that the Rambam had a lot of respect for the Gaonim, and that's what we're usually told. But he says, but not all the Gaonim, because there are some Gaonim, he says that the Rambam says they didn't know how to learn. Pshuto kamashmao, they didn't know how to learn. And then he cites Rav Avram ben Arambam, which I don't know if this is actually an actual quote, because I looked and I could not find this. He says there were some Gaonim who were like sandalarim, like shoemakers. And he says if a Gaon died, they picked a shoemaker and said, you know how to learn a little, we'll make you the Gaon. Yesh Gaonim Shalohandu must speak. There's some Gaonim that didn't learn very well. But there are those Gaonim that you need to respect them. That's what Rav Soloveitchik quoted as his grandfather, Haim, saying that not all the Gaonim knew how to learn. Remember, it was a political position, the Gaonim. You're appointed. So we know that when you ever have political appointments, you have chief rabbis, all this, not all of them are Gaonim Gadol Yisrael. People are appointed for political reasons and everything, so it's interesting. More interesting, perhaps, is what appears on the very same page, about 15 lines below, Rabbi Mazuz gets in. I don't know why it's not Pesach time, but he gets into the, he starts speaking about the issue of the size of a kazayis and how you determine it. And he says that, you know, the Ashkenazim have these very big kazayisim. So why do the Ashkenazim, like a matzah and everything, have such big sizes of the olive? And listen to what he says. And now, he said this before. If you look in Rabbi Slifkin's new book, which is basically a collection of his essays, he has an essay on the growing kazayis, the growing olive. And he cites Rabbi Mazuz. He cites it because I gave it to him. You know, I'm the one who's reading Rabbi Mazuz. But this is what Rabbi Mazuz says. He quotes Tosfos. He first of all, he says the Tosfos says that a kazayis, an olive, is half a beitza, half an egg. The Tosfos only kirot as eitzim. The Tosfos didn't know what the what olives were. And then he says, how do we know this? He says, lo ra'u otam b'chayim shalem. The Tosfos never saw an olive. Olives never made it there. There were olives in Spain, but they never made it up to where the Tosafists were. And he brings a proof for this. He has other proofs as well. The Gemara says that an olive is bitter. Do you know what Tosaf says? Tosaf says it's two times. He says it in Shabbos. I think it's Shabbos. He says in Erevin and he says in Pesachim. Tosfos, he tries to bring a proof from the way he learns the Gemara or the Halachic Midrash that an olive is sweet. So what does Tosaf says? Tosfos says that when the Gemara says an olive is bitter, it's referring, the Gemara wants to know why, you know, you can't use it as maror. He says it refers to the tree. That if you take a piece of bark off and you bite on it, it'll be bitter. So, but not the olive as well. But Rabbi Mazuz says, mechila mikvodchem, with all due respect, Tosfos, take a zayit that's not like pickled, the tagidu im hu mar o matok. And you tell me, Tosfos, whether it's sweet or sour or bitter. And then we says, hayom anachnu yodim shazayit hu mar pshuko mashmao. Today we know that an olive is bitter. Ela shabat sarfat. Yesh mekomot shalo hayo yaham zeytim. In France, they didn't have this. And that's why Tosfos could say, you know, an olive is not half a size of a, to take a look at an olive and take a look at the size of an egg. An olive is not half the size of an egg. But that's why Tosfos could say that. This affects us because, or at least affects some of us because the Tosfos, because then the Noda Behuda had the issue and the Chazon Ish. So if you ever look at what the size of an olive is, what they tell you to eat, and you wonder about the size of the olives you look at. So then they say, well, our olives are smaller. We know our olives are not smaller. We have olives from 2,000 years ago. They have them, which have been preserved. And if you look in the Sephardic world, they had the tradition always of how big these things were. And there's never been any changes in the Sephardic world. The number, the amount they give you then is the same they give you now. I showed you this book. Petichat HaEgrot from Rabbi Yonasan Rossman, where he goes through the different Tumos Negros Moshe and he brings various comments on it. It's like a collection of all the comments, including from things you wouldn't expect, quoting from the Sfarim blog and all sorts of things. Well, he came out with a new volume, a shorter one, Hosafot. And I thank Editions. I thank Rabbi Rossman for sending it to me. So why do I mention it? Because over Shabbos, I was looking at it, and lo and behold, on page 21, he deals with the issue we spoke about last week, about inviting a non-Jew to your house, inviting a non-religious person on Shabbos. And he quotes Rabbi Yosef Adler, who's the brother of Rabbi Aaron Adler. I'm surprised Rabbi Aaron Adler didn't mention it in the book, that Rabbi Soloveitchik agreed with Rosh Zalman Auerbach, that you can invite people even though they're going to drive. Now, this is in contradiction to what Rav Schachter quotes him. So I don't know what to make of that, but that's what he says. And Rabbi Schachter also quotes Rav Schachter and Rabbi Amital, who also agreed with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and Rav Lichtenstein agreed with it, followed Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So quite interesting as well. Also, I'll just tell you, because we use the book, he cites Rabbi Schachter again on page 31, who refers to this book, which I know this book, Devar Chevron. This is the book by Rabbi Dov Lior. How do I know it? Because I bought it. This is the book that has the Tshuva Temiyan that we discussed. But I didn't go through one of the sections very well because it's on Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat, civil law, doesn't interest me that much. So I skim it, but I don't really read it. But I should have read it because lo and behold, Rabbi Schachter gives an example. we've mentioned this a number of times. To be a posek, you could be the greatest posek in the world, but if you don't know the mitzios, as we say in yeshiva, then your psak is going to be all wrong. I mean, if you give a psak on something and you're describing it incorrectly, then it's incorrect. Doesn't matter that you could be the gadol hador. By the way, we gave an example of Rabbi Jachter himself, with all due respect to him, where he didn't have the facts. I mean, remember the one about the Uber Eats? He said that he was told that an Uber Eats driver could eat some of the food that he's delivering, which of course is not true and never could be true. So that that affects the psak also. But what is it? It's as a great example. It's on page 230, number Kuf Aleph. Rabbi Lior was asked the following question. They're playing basketball, and in the basketball game, one of the players broke the other player's glasses. So is he responsible to pay him back, to buy him new glasses? And Rabbi Lior goes through the sources, and then he says that if it's a game and you all agreed to play, then you've agreed that your glasses could be destroyed, you could be injured. But then he says, and listen to this, this is in a regular game where you're playing and you cause damage to someone else, the next person who causes damage is Patur. Because they both agreed to play. They agreed to, by playing, they're assuming that these things could happen. But then he says, listen to this. But in the current case, the basketball case, the Toveya claims that, you owe me it. Why? He says, I'll pi klalei hamishchak. Based upon the rules of the game, as I have investigated it, listen to this. Ein shum zechut l'tzadcha keneged l'hotzia tzakadur b'koach. You can't, according to the rules of basketball, as I was told, when you're holding the ball, the other person can't try to grab it out of you and take it away. And therefore, there's no mechila. The other person broke the rules and he broke your glasses. Well, as Rabbi Jachter correctly points out, Rabbi Lior, who could be a great Talmud Chacham, he doesn't know the first thing about basketball. All of us know who play basketball, that I could be holding the ball, and of course the guy could grab it out of my hand. Hopefully I'll be able to hold on to it, and it's a jump ball. But here's a perfect example of where, and it says he investigated it. By the way, not just investigated, in the question itself said, I ni hechzakti et hakadur, I held the ball, ulefi kalei hamishchak asur lotzi b'koach. According to the rules of basketball, you can't pull it out of my hands. That's completely false. Now, if the guy who pulled it out of his hands also thinks that's the rules, then Rabbi Lior is correct. But assuming the guy who pulled it out knows the rules, then of course you can pull the basketball. If I'm holding the ball over here, we teach the kids to pull the ball out. So that's of interest. And finally, the last thing, the Masoras Moshe, 4 volumes, full of good stuff on Rav Moshe Feinstein. I was looking at this on Shabbos, on volume 4, page 61, we get back to the issue we spoke about on traveling on an airplane and Hagomel. Rav Moshe held that if you fly, let's say, to England, and then you fly back, I mentioned it before already, that you only make the bracha when you come back, unless if you're there under 30 days. And he repeats this here and explains why that is. So that's not the general practice. I think the general practice is that the people who bench Gomel assume that you do it when you go there. Israel, he says, it could be different. He says, Israel, a few times he said that maybe you're in Israel, Mashiach comes because you're going to stay there, so you could say it. But for example, we have these trips, and God willing, we'll start these trips January, Morocco. God willing, January, Morocco, sign up. Because we hope to sell out. Everyone wants to travel. But, we have these trips. People fly. And then we have a minyan. And it's not like people ever say to me, well, I need an aliyah, make a gomel. Sometimes if they get an aliyah, they'll say it. My sense has always been that people just don't feel, we travel a lot, that they don't need to dafka make a gomel. But maybe not. Maybe they're all holding like Rav Moshe, that they'll make the gomel when they get back, because that's what Rav Moshe held. Of course, I don't think anyone really knows Rav Moshe's sheet on this, because it really isn't accepted. Because the idea generally, you think you fly in an airplane, if it's dangerous, you make the bracha. But Rav Moshe has a different understanding of this. So, Ad Kan. Let me put this down. The tradition is you get an aliyah, you make it. But you don't need an aliyah. as long as there's 10 people there, you can make the bracha without an aliyah. You know, if there's 10 people want to make the agomo, if you're all on an airplane and there's a problem, it's shaking and it was a dangerous situation, you're all going to want to make agomo. We only have 3 aliyahs, let's say Monday morning. So you can still make the bracha even if you don't have an aliyah. We are continuing in the book. The appendix, the letters of Yonah Emanuel to me. So I'm just going to continue with some of the things he says, things I think you'll find of interest. I'm on page 362. I wasn't going to say something, but I'll just say it because it's here. He wrote me about Rabbi Jacobowitz. Rabbi Yonah Emanuel was, I guess, I wouldn't say a right winger, but a conservative, a Netanyahu person. In some of the letters here, he's talking about 1997. He's talking about, it looks like Netanyahu's on his way out. And here we are 24 years later. It's the same thing. But Rabbi Jacobowitz, his name, incidentally, Immanuel, he was named after Immanuel Kant, to give you a sense of how German Jews, acculturated, assimilated, I don't know which term you want to use. There was another rabbi in Germany. His name was Pinchas Bieberfeld. His father was a doctor. He became a doctor at like age 40 in Berlin, Eduard Bieberfeld, Chaim Bieberfeld. He wrote a book on Hilchos Shabbos, but he was considered a classic example of German Orthodoxy, joining, you know, secular studies with Torah. His son, Pinchas Bieberfeld, that's what he's known in Israel. He edited the Torah journal HaNe'eman. After the war, he comes back and he's a rabbi in Munich. He's a student of Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, but his real name is Paul, and he was named after Hindenburg. Paul Hindenburg, after they won one of these battles, his father, who's one of the leading rabbis in the separatist Adas Yisrael Hildesheimer community, names his son after Hindenburg. Why is Jacobowitz named after Immanuel Kant? One of the times I spoke to him, I asked him this question, and he said it's a long story, and unfortunately I never got to speak to him again. He passed away. He came to Brandeis to speak, believe it or not, the kollel at Brandeis brought him in. And that's when I asked him, but he is named after Immanuel Kant. His father was a rabbi in Berlin, although he grew up in England. Rabbi Jacobowitz was known as a conservative, Margaret Thatcher's favorite clergyman, because she didn't like the Archbishop of Canterbury. So just like Jonathan Sacks was everyone's favorite clergyman in England, if you're at least all the non-Jews, because he's not telling you what to do as a Christian, he's Jewish. So and Immanuel Jacobowitz made many important statements. He was the first chief rabbi to become a lord. They all were sirs, but actually take that back. I don't know if Hertz was a sir, but Brody was a sir. And he was in the House of Lords, and he spoke about issues of morality. He said certain things that today couldn't be said. And like, for instance, just because we're in Pride Month, which is recognized all over the world, except if you go to certain countries, and Muslim countries and Russia, they don't recognize it and they don't change the colors. So, you know, they speak about Israel and the oppressive. Go to these other countries. It's like the old joke that, not joke, the serious thing, that the gays in Gaza, the best place they could be is Tel Aviv. But Rabbi Jacobowitz wrote that if they found a way to in utero, like alter the genetic structure, whatever it is, so the person wouldn't come out gay, then that's something to explore. That's the sort of thing that could be said in the 90s. Today it would be very problematic. But he's a very conservative, a big free market person, and a person who believed in really a Thatcherite, I think, in terms of her policies. However, he also was quite liberal when it came to Israel, in terms of giving back land. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin came out publicly against him once and said that, this is quoted in the Jewish Chronicle, that British Jewry should spit him out because he's completely unsuited to be a rabbi with some of his comments. And Jacobowitz writes how he went to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Soloveitchik told him to keep speaking your conscience. But at least what Rabbi Emanuel, Yonah Emanuel writes to me, he says that my opinion of Rabbi Lord Jacobowitz is different than yours. And he says that, I don't remember what I was discussing with him, but he says that we had a correspondence, and because he sent me the speech he gave before the Organization of European Rabbis in ER of 1996, right after certain terrible terrorist attacks here. And what did he speak about? He said that we also have to understand the Tsaram, the pain of the mothers of the suicide bombers. And he said, Emmanuel says, that to me goes beyond any understanding. And how could a rabbi speak like this? And how could you say this before a group of rabbis? So I'm assuming what Jacobovitz said was something like that, that even, you know, we have to recognize that they're feeling pain also. We don't appreciate the actions they did, obviously, but the parents also are suffering. I think if he'd be living today, he'd know that they're not suffering. Half the time these parents get up, one of the mothers was just on TV a couple of weeks ago saying, we're happy that my son's a martyr. They want martyrdom. But this is a while ago, and maybe we didn't have that sense. So I'm assuming that's what Rabbi Jacobovitz was speaking about, that maybe he was saying that that we should recognize that there's pain on the other side, something like that. I don't know. I don't know the context. But that's why Yonah Emanuel was not very happy with Rabbi and Lord Jacobovitz. Another thing about Rabbi Lord Jacobovitz is that for some reason, even in the Haredi world, all of a sudden he starts becoming called Lord Jacobovitz. Everyone calls him Lord Jacobovitz. Isn't rabbi the most important title? Why do we call it? Why, if he's Rabbi Jacobovitz then, he's Rabbi Jacobovitz now. All of a sudden, Lord Jacobovitz. It always troubled me because you want to call him Rabbi Lord, fine. But Lord Jacobovitz, now Lord, a title awarded by a British monarch, is now more important than the rabbinic title. And for the Haredi world, that they would refer to him as Lord Jacobovitz also, very unusual. He then says that I'll be very happy if you have, I have a collection, it's on the floor over here, of a material from Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. I published some of it, but some I still haven't. The great posek in Germany. He says, he dies in 1923, as I recall. I'd be very happy if you publish responsa from Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman in Hamayan. He was the uncle of my father. And in our house, we had a picture, a big picture of him. He says, my father was an orphan, and therefore Rabbi Hoffman came to his bar mitzvah in Hamburg, and that's the first time he met Isaac Halevi, the author of Dorot HaRishonim, and he gives the date, Parshas Mishpatim in 1907. Keep, remember this. You'll see why this is relevant later. In the next letter to me, which is from Tishrei of, I guess this is 1996, because it's Tishrei, Tovshin Nun Zion, he begins by saying, I was in the Kotel, I daven Vasikin, Nates, during Chol HaMoed. Then he says, in my neighborhood, there's a lot of Americans. I get along well with them. And he asked me a question. What is this book of Daniel Goldhagen that I'm hearing about? Okay, I'll come back to this. If you don't know who Daniel Goldhagen is, stay tuned. We'll get back to it because he writes more about him. It was like the most significant book published in 1996. I believe that was the year it came out. We'll get back to that in a second. He goes, people are talking about a book that accuses the entire German nation. And he says, that's certainly true. So we'll come back to Goldhagen in a minute. The next letter, just a month later, I had published something I found from Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. When the Hebrew University was going to be established, the question was, should Orthodox Jews, German Jews were wondering, should we be involved with it? And there was a Professor Frankel, who was a mathematician, becomes very involved, but he wrote to Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman has a very, he's from the separatist community, and he sets out a way that it is okay to be involved with the Hebrew University, but it's almost undoable. He thinks that there needs to be two separate faculties and that the monies of the Orthodox have to be completely separate. It's not, it was undoable, but why this is significant is it shows you that Rav David Zvi Hoffman, he says, though, we can't let it be that there's a university and we have no involvement with it. We have to try to have some involvement. The problem is we believe in separatism, so we can't be part of a university, a structure in which it supports heresy, things like that. So he's trying to find ways of creating a system where the Orthodox are there, but separated. Is it possible? I guess in theory it would be. They were even thinking about having a rabbinical seminary at the Hebrew University, but it never happened. It never came to fruition. And the second letter I published, or the third letter, he says that I take back what I told you because he spoke to people. It seems that he didn't have all the facts. It was too controversial, apparently. But the Yeshiva University, this is going to be in the news in the next months. Some of you probably know what I'm going to say now. Yeshiva University changed their charter in the early 70s. Yeshiva University is a secular university. completely secular, and the rabbinical school and the morning where you learn Gemara, that's Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary, that's religious. Why this is going to be in the news? Because there's a lawsuit right now. Yeshiva University is a secular university, takes government money, and they felt that they were able to forbid the forming of a gay club. Well, how can you forbid a gay club if you're a secular university? I can't see for the life of me how this will ever be upheld. Maybe if you were in Alabama, but in New York, it's hard to imagine how, and especially because the law school had this issue in the medical school. Now there's no medical school, but the law school. So this is going to go to court, and they're stuck with the problem that they can change the charter and make it a religious university again, but then that'll create all sorts of issues. Look, I work at a religious university, University of Scranton. It's able to run okay. I don't see any reason why Yeshiva University cannot be a religious university. But right now it's a secular university, and that means that they are bound by everything that Rutgers and Penn State is bound by as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik warned about this, that it would create problems, and everyone else said, no, it's not an issue, and Dr. Belkin said it's not an issue. Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke openly about this, and that was the last time like they let Rabbi Soloveitchik speak publicly. The students were protesting, and it created problems because he went against Dr. Belkin. And until about 2 years ago, everyone would have said, well, it turns out Dr. Belkin was absolutely correct. They changed the charter, and nothing ever mattered. The university ran the exact same way it ran. But now we're going to see if it's going to be an issue because, as I said, I can't see how a secular university could, YU is making the claim that we're a secular university with religious values. But, and just like we could ban, for instance, if you want to have a society, you want to have a Nazi society on campus, they you can ban it. Rutgers could ban a Nazi society also. So once you're allowed, I assume you can, at least that's what YU's claiming, that they can, that there are certain things that they can ban if they feel it goes against the ethos of the university. Remains to be seen. The next letter, also from Mar Cheshvan Tavshin Nun Zion, is what it relates to. I sent him after he told me, he just told me for the sake of telling me when his father's bar mitzvah was, and he gave me the date. Lo and behold, I have a letter which I sent to him, which I then would publish, in which in the letter it mentions that I'm writing this when I'm returning from a bar mitzvah in Hamburg, and it gives the date. Incredibly, I discovered a letter that Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman happened to write right when he came back, and he mentions this. So I sent it to Yonah Manuel, and he got a lot of nachas from it. On page 364, the next letter, he asks me, I sent him my doctoral dissertation, and in there I cite letters that Rabbi Weinberg wrote to Samuel Atlas, and then I published these letters. So let me tell you about this a little bit. There was a man, and I should have got a picture of him for you, so you could. I didn't. I just till now I didn't realize that I would be mentioning him. Let me see if I get a picture of him, Professor Samuel Atlas. No, I'm not getting a picture of him, but he is a scholar, a Slabodka person. Let's see if I get a picture of him. I'm not getting Professor Samuel Atlas. He was a big Talmud Chacham. He published the Raivad on Bava Kama, which in all the yeshivas they use, but he becomes more secular. Like you see the pictures of him. He's not wearing a yarmulke. He taught at the Hebrew Union College. He was not Reform, although people sometimes say that, but he was not Orthodox. And he was like Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg's closest friend. And we have letters from Rabbi Weinberg to him, and we get insight, unbelievable insight into Weinberg's closest, his most innermost thoughts. Let me tell the story because I don't, I've told the story, but never online. So tell the story now. So this Samuel Atlas, who some yeshivas, they refuse to use his edition of the Raiva, but there's a response in the Sri D'Yesh to him. If those who were in New York, you might remember him. First he taught in Cincinnati, and then he taught in New York. And Samuel Atlas published a few letters that Rabbi Weinberg wrote him. And the fact that he's such close friends with this man and the letters, I wanted to see these letters because I'm doing a doctoral dissertation. those who've read my book know that the last chapter would have been much less without these incredible letters. So I figured, you never know, maybe his widow is alive. This is taking me back to like 1989. I was living in Brookline then, so it's 1992. I look in the phone book, and there's a Mrs. Samuel Atlas is listed there. So I call and I speak to this woman, a very old woman. And I was surprised, first of all, to find someone. And I asked her, and she told me, yes, all about Rabbi Weinberg. Her husband was very close to him. Her husband died, I think, at 77, I believe, at the age of 77. She was probably 90, around 90 then, maybe 88, something like that. And I say, well, where are the letters of Rabbi Weinberg to your husband? And she says, well, I gave them a few years ago to the Jewish Theological Seminary, but I requested that no one can see them till I pass away. Now, I had been to JTS. I know the library very well, the archives. I worked there for many years. I had never seen anything from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg to Samuel Atlas. Furthermore, I looked in the card catalog. There wasn't anything there. I went through everything. So I was a little surprised. As soon as I could, at the time I was in Brookline, I went down to New York and I went to the seminary. And again, I had nothing on the computer, nothing in the card catalog. And yet she told me that she had given them to the seminary. So I insisted to the librarian upstairs, I think it was David Wachtel, if the name means anything to you. I said, I was told they're here. Remember, I also was told that she said no one could look at them. He calls up Professor Schmelzer. Menachem Schmelzer was the librarian. And Schmelzer tells him, yes, we have it. And he describes exactly where it is. He goes in. Within 2 minutes, he brings it out. It was on a shelf. It wasn't cataloged or whatever. A big, thick folder. He puts it, gives it to me, sits it on the table in the reading room there. I open it up. Okay, now what I'm going to tell you now, some of you might not appreciate, might think I made a mistake, I was wrong, immoral, whatever. In the end, all's well that ends well. But I'm being honest, I'm telling you exactly what happened, and it was my Yetzer Hara. I open it up, and right there, there's a letter from, a copy of a letter from Professor Schmelzer to Mrs. Atlas. Professor Schmelzer obviously forgot about this letter. It was maybe 5 years before. Dear Mrs. Atlas, thank you very much for this important collection of correspondence that you gave us between your husband and Rabbi Weinberg. I've informed Professor Lieberman of this, and in accordance with your wishes, it will remain unviewable until your passing. So here I am. He shouldn't have given it to me. But it's in front of me, and this is the most important stuff you could ever find. Obviously, if you're a reporter, you do what you have to do. That's your job. But here I'm an academic, a scholar, but this is the most important writings I could ever imagine. I knew that these were going to be the private ideas of Rabbi Weinberg, who doesn't have a wife, doesn't have children, to his closest friend, who's not in the Orthodox world. So you get all sorts of insights. So I have a big problem here. Do I close it up? And this is going to make my dissertation, my book. So I read the letters. I have to say that I read the letters. So now you might think it was wrong. It's this. I did read the letters. And I was, after reading them, I said, this is an unbelievable find. And I was didn't feel guilty at all reading them because I thought this was vital, important information. And I called Mrs. Atlas later that night. And I told her I was at the library. They gave it to me, and I saw her correspondence. She said to me, well, you know, I told them not to show it to anyone. And I said, yeah, I know, but they showed it to me. But the thing is, she was worried that there was personal stuff in there, which there really wasn't. The only personal stuff is they never had children. So there was discussions there about adopting a Holocaust child who had survived. But I explained to her what was in that. And after I explained to her and I read it, she agreed. That, okay, I agree, you can use the letters and I give you permission. So that's what I mean. Sof tov, hakol tov. All's well that ends well. She said I couldn't, but once I did and I explained to her what's in there, she agreed that I should be able to see it. And then based on her agreement, JTS gave me approval to use the letters. I don't know how long, I don't think I still have exclusive use. Because when you study one of these manuscripts, they give you exclusive use for a certain number of years. So no one else, you can't have two people using the same manuscripts. I don't think this is now 30 years. So I don't think I still have exclusive use. Anyone could go there. But the seminary gave me exclusive use of these letters. And I use them in my book. And also I published the selection of them in this article in the Toramata Journal called Scholars and Friends, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and Samuel Atlas, which created a huge controversy because of some of the things Rabbi Weinberg said. Well, one of the things that he speaks about in these letters, and this is what I quote from, is that Rabbi Weinberg says that it's a daring thing to say, but he's wondering why everyone hates us. We can ask the question today. He says, is it possible that maybe some of the, that we're responsible for some of this because the way we treat the non-Jews? And he mentions certain halachot, which discriminate against non-Jews. And he says, and maybe that's why they have negative feelings towards us. Now, it's probably actually the reverse. It's probably because the non-Jews treated the Jews poorly, and therefore the Jews responded, well, if you're not, if you don't treat our property properly, then we don't have to treat your property, that sort of thing. That's what I think is probably what happened. But Rabbi Weinberg is trying to find, it's a very daring thing. He's saying that maybe we share some of the blame. And not to excuse it, of course, but to talk about a situation. If you're in a town, for instance, and every time you walk by the non-Jews, you don't say hello to them, you ignore them, you think you're better than them, it's not going to be a surprise if all of a sudden they start regarding you negatively. If you're in a town and you don't follow zoning rules and everything, and next thing you know, you have like an anti-Semitic group in down by Lakewood, which isn't just speaking about zoning, but speak about other things. You know, the actions have consequences. Chil Hashem is something the sages spoke about. It's not something made up, Chil Hashem. So Rabbi Weinberg writes in this letter that we have to declare that these halachot that the Talmud speaks about no longer apply today. Negative things about non-Jews. So he asks me, what does he mean by this? Are we supposed to change the halachot? And later on, I respond to him, and he responds as well, that what Rabbi Weinberg is speaking about is the idea of the Meiri. And he says so explicitly in one of his books, the great sage from Provence, Menachem Meiri, says that all these laws that trouble students when they're in high school, that distinctions between Jews and non-Jews in monetary matters, the Meiri says they do not apply to civilized people, good people, they don't apply to. And that's become the standard accepted view in German Orthodoxy, in modern Orthodoxy. But that's what he's referring to here. And that was Rabbi Weinberg. It's incredible that after the Holocaust, when he had suffered so much and so many else, that he still was asking this question about, how do we treat the non-Jews? Because after the Holocaust, many people's ideas was, we saw Rabbi Menashe Klein. That's the last question you ask, how we treat non-Jews. On the contrary, they're all deserving whatever they get. Then he has some comments about the leftists who oppose Zionism and things like that. We can skip that. On page 365, I had sent him materials about the controversy Turo. Turo, he opened up a branch in Jerusalem, and the Gedolim from the Haredi were Shach and others, they came out condemning Turo. They did it in New York also. An isser, a chayrim. Today, no one would care. There's so much going on. And I sent it to him, and he says, it's interesting. There's this new dispute about secular studies for B'nai Yeshivot, the students of Yeshivot. It continues in Israel because you have these technical schools, these other schools for people in the Haredi world. And there's so every year they come out with these isserim, these bans. You can't go there. Girls can't go there. They come out with all these things. And then what does it show you? All these bans that the people are going there. And they're going there, and they're not losing their Haredi identity, and they're getting jobs. It's such an extremist approach to try to keep them ignorant of any secular studies. I don't want to be cynical, but I think there's a lot of it is two things. First, to keep them in the yeshiva world. They're afraid if they go out, if they get a job, they won't be loyal anymore to the ideals of the yeshiva world. That they say explicitly, but the cynical thing might think that they no longer will then be under the control of the rabbis. Also poverty. We have statements of Haredi Gedolim that we want the people to be poor. Because if they're poor, and you don't want the women to earn a lot of money either, because they said that'll create a cultural gap. So when people are poor, they're much easier to control. that's the only way I can explain it. What's wrong with going to school and learning how to do computers, or, you know, whatever they teach you to make a living? It's very strange, the whole situation. And he says that Rabbi Abraham Unterweiser, he was the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. He says he was a number of years a member of the Aguda, and they gave him much respect. But when the Aguda decided, and this would have been, I don't know what year he's referring to, but that they're only going to support yeshivas that don't have secular studies, he left the Aguda. Jacob Rosenheim was forced to agree to this, but he at least not oppose it. And that's really the issue. German Orthodoxy, as we said last week, used to have a place in the Aguda. They're the founders of it. But at least in Israel, and was the case in Europe as well, as we get closer to the war years, that the German Orthodox approach was no longer given legitimacy, even for Germany. I'm trying to finish if I can tonight, we'll see. On page 366, he refers to a letter I sent him, and then I published it in Kisvei Rechayek of Weinberg. This is what Rabbi Weinberg says in a letter to Yonah Emanuel. He says as follows. In my opinion, you should print the second section of my article. He wrote an article on Rabbi Hirsch. Listen to what Rabbi Weinberg says. Particularly, this is on page 354 in volume 2 of the writings of Rabbi Weinberg, particular because those people who oppose, those circles who oppose the approach of Rabbi Hirsch, namely Shamshon Raphael Hirsch of secular studies, they have hatred to any article which shows an academic sense. Against these circles, the Gaonim, Rabbi Hirsch and Rabbi Hildesheimer, spoke against. Even today, he says, the situation is such that we need to stress that Hamada science is not in opposition to us. We don't oppose secular studies. We don't oppose science. If it doesn't have a throwing off of the tradition, or if it's not denying Torah. In my opinion, he says, Afidati al Yotzei Ashkenaz Achzik, the German Orthodox Jews must strongly hold on to the view of Torah in Derech Eretz, Torah and civilization, in its widest sense, and not to be pulled after the extremists who oppose it. And he says, it is good that you publish the memoirs of Dr. Jacob Levy. He was an elderly German Jew who wrote memoirs. He says that if I can, I will, if my health permits it, I will also write articles on German Orthodoxy. He says there is no substitute for German Orthodoxy. He says the religious world has been conquered by Hasidut, and the yeshiva movement. But the Musar ideas of the yeshiva. But unfortunately, they have passed over, he says, independent, sophisticated thought. Right. Chashivut Rayonit Makorit. He's saying that in the yeshiva world and the Hasidic world, they're very pious, they've taken over, but you don't have independent, sophisticated thinking. And you, Hamayan, he says, the Torah Journal for German Orthodoxy, you must continue with this tradition, a tradition, he says, that was rebuked at first by the great rabbis of Lithuania and Poland, and in the end, they recognized how important it was. So a very important statement by Rabbi Weinberg about the significance of Torah in Derech Eretz. Then he thanks me for the letter I sent him from the Netziv. We spoke about this in the classes on the Netziv. The Netziv also was not opposed to secular studies. He didn't want it in the yeshiva. I published a letter, you find it after the appendix of this book, that's the very last thing, in which Netziv writes that secular studies are fine. But everything in the top place, he writes this to his grandson, the son of Rabbi Chaim Berlin, everything in its proper place and time. You don't have secular studies in the yeshiva. First, you give Torah studies. And once someone has filled his belly with Torah, then you can study secular studies. And that's fine. But you don't study them like they do in Germany, where you study them at the same time. Then he says to me, Professor Breuer gave me his copy of the German translation of Daniel Goldhagen. And then he says, he goes on with my machutan, Dr. Zimmer, etc. But in the next letter to me, he goes into detail about this book. Here is the book. This is taking us back a ways. Hitler's Willing Executioners, 1996. Paperback was 1997. Daniel Goldhagen. This book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, you can see how the whole Wikipedia page, it became the most popular, really most talked about book of the year. And it took issue with other important books, including this classic work in Holocaust studies, Ordinary Men, Christopher Browning, Reserve Battalion 101, The Final Solution of Poland. What is Goldhagen's book? Ordinary Germans in the Holocaust. It was one of the executioners. This is Ordinary Men. It became, as I said, he became a superstar, Goldhagen. You haven't heard of him now. I think in the end, he didn't get tenure at Harvard, and he hasn't really heard of since. He was the leading academic in the world for about 2 years, commanding probably $50,000 a talk, speaking all over the world. For whatever reason, his book became a sensation, and I highly encourage everyone to read it, even if in the academic world, it basically has been rejected. His argument was that, first of all, the Holocaust, of course, is due to anti-Semitism, but only anti-Semitism, an eliminationist form of anti-Semitism, and that can explain Germany, and it's something special about Germany. Why this was so controversial is because, for instance, Browning in his book showed that you had many people, they called them the Einsatzgruppen. These were people, the mobile killing squads, before they, right after the invasion of the Soviet Union, the first deaths, the ones you think of, you see shooting people in the pits and everything, that was during the invasion of Russia. Later then, with the Jews in Poland, they were in the ghettos, they were deported to Auschwitz. But the first mass killings were by these Einsatzgruppen, these mobile killing squads. And because we have the trials of these people in the 60s, we know a lot about them. Browning was interested, he taught for many years at Pacific Lutheran University, and this is also classic work, although it never sold as many as Goldhagen, but he wanted to understand the phenomenon of these people who there's no evidence that they were ever anti-Semitic before the war, that they were not Nazis, many of them. These were older people, sometimes in their 40s, and they weren't in the regular army. And the point of the book is to show how ordinary people who, if you look at them 5 years before, they have nothing in particular against Jews. Jews, it's not even something on their mind. We're not talking about Nazis. We're not talking about, but put in a situation, they can become bloodthirsty killers. When I say bloodthirsty killers, I mean, you read the memoir, the stories there, and Goldhagen uses the same information. They would go out on these Jew hunts. And that was the thrill. Even once when the band comes, the musicians, they come, they hear they're going on a Jew hunt, so they go along too. And what they would do to children and women, and this became the fun, the game. Browning's point was that these are ordinary people, and that the argument is that, yes, they were turned into genocidal maniacs, but not because they were anti-Semitic per se from their birth or from their growing up, not because they always hated Jews, and that anyone in a situation, if they don't have a strong moral character, could be turned in a certain way. And that's the significance of Nazi Germany. And you can point to other genocides, and the idea that this could only happen in Germany, it couldn't happen in another country, it couldn't happen. Well, that's what Goldhagen says, it couldn't happen in Italy. But so it became a huge debate. Is there something special about Germany and the people who would go along with that, like in Lithuania or the Ukraine? Or is this something that that people, for advancement, for personal advancement, because they didn't want to show that they were weak, or that people will choose to engage in mass murder for all sorts of other reasons. You can even kill someone, murder them, and you don't have anything against them. But you know, if this is going to get me a raise, if this is going to make me look good among the people, it's two diametrically opposed interpretations of what we can say about these killers, who, as I said, have no evidence of anti-Semitism, obviously not genocidal hatred of Jews before the war. So he writes to me about this, he agrees with Goldhagen, he lived through it, he saw it, the hatred. Of course there's the hatred, but that's not the issue. The issue is this the hatred that is specific to Germany because of the culture of hatred of Jews for so long, or could anyone from any society put in that situation also be turned into such a genocidal maniac. That's what the issue. I have to say that the big scholars like Yehuda Bauer, Raoul Hilberg, they also came out very, very strongly against Goldhagen, because Goldhagen has what they call a monocausal explanation of the Holocaust. And the argument is that something so so significant with so much going on can never be explained in one way. He notes, however, in the German edition of this, he has a preface in which he sort of backtracks his views, in which he says, but the Germany today is a different Germany. They were given democracy and anti-Semitism is so important. So he wants to know, if I heard anything, what's going on here. He 9 pages in the beginning, a new preface destroys his entire argument. But if you don't know about the Goldhagen and you're interested in this, all you have to do is Google it. You can go to Wikipedia under the book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, and there'll be all sorts of discussions about this. I remember I just started teaching Holocaust when it came out, and I have a whole collection. Books came out about the Goldhagen thesis. And then he published another book about the Catholic Church and anti-Semitism, and then wasn't heard from again. And he has a website, but I don't know what he does. And it was a one-hit wonder. But when I say a one-hit wonder, I mean someone who reached the high, a superstar, like a Jordan Peterson type of superstar, or Ibram X. Kendi type of academic superstar, where he had to work quickly because he only had his 15 minutes of fame, but maybe he made enough money to carry him on forever. But it was such an important book, and the questions it, and he must have known it was, because he got this PhD at Harvard, and all the PhDs you can access this, but you have the ability, if you want, to say for like 5 years it can't be seen. And I remember I wanted to go like the dissertation and you couldn't see it. So I highly recommend Daniel Goldhagen's book, at the very least, even if you don't accept his theoretical exposition of what's behind the murderers and what makes them tick, just to read the history, the events as they're described, what these people did, the Einsatzgruppen, how they could do the things they did and still think of themselves as human. As Emmanuel cites a passage in the book that Goldhagen cites, that this German officer refused to sign a document that, read what he says, based upon his on honor, he refused to sign a document pledging not to take any things that don't belong to him, not to steal. They made all these people sign when they went into foreign territory, they wouldn't take any booty. And he refused because it's a matter of honor that he wouldn't do such a thing. You know, of course, I'll never steal, and I won't sign it as a matter of honor because you would even suspect that I would do that. And this is the same person who has such a high sense of honor that he wouldn't sign a document that implied that he might steal, is going to slaughter men, women, and children. And he says himself, I saw what I, he saw it also. He was in Bergen-Belsen. I only have 5 more minutes, so I'm going to continue. We'll be able to finish the book. He deals in his letter in 1999 with this Rabbi Weinberg in the Collected Writings of Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, Volume 1, Number 3. I publish Rabbi Weinberg's responsum. We could do the same thing if we did with the writings of Rabbi Weinberg on using a microphone on Shabbos. And he mentions there's a dispute. He gives all the sources here, but then he says, 2 years ago, Rabbi Grossness came here with Professor Dohm. Rabbi Grossness, R.E.L. Grossness, he was a dayan on the London Basin, and Professor Cyril Dohm, who's a very well-known scientist, they came here to speak to Rabbi Herzog. This is a letter from 1960. Rabbi Herzog, chief rabbi of Israel, was in Montreux, Switzerland at the time. And I recommended to Rabbi Herzog, he says, don't give a halachic ruling unless you get all the Gedolim of Jerusalem to agree with you. Why? Because there are kana'im gedolim she'enam modim ala emes. There are those extremist rabbis who do not acknowledge the truth, but they are machmir, they're stringent, just based upon their thinking, their feelings, rigshei libam. V'imam ein le'takeach. You can't argue with them. V'heim chashudim gam al shvichas dam shalom akilim. And these people, these rabbis, you have to also suspect them of shvichos damim, of murdering the people who are more lenient. And therefore, I said that Chief Rabbi Brody should also not give a ruling. What does he mean? Shechatamim spilling their blood doesn't mean literal murder, but it means destroying people. You come after a rabbi who he thinks gives a lenient opinion, and you're going to destroy him. So he's Emmanuel thought this was a significant passage. He says that I want to bring you a proof from this from a woman, Ruth Blau, in her book. Ruth Blau was the French woman who converted, who married Amram Blau, the Neturei Karta. Some of you might know the story. The Neturei Karta didn't, and Ida Haredi didn't want to let Amram Blau marry her because she was a convert. And she writes about that. So that's an example of extremists. But then he says, why do I have to bring from them? He says, once I went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I was with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach after a shir. And on his steps, I guess they walked him back to his house, there was a lot of extremists, Kanaim Rabin. And they were, some of them were pushing themselves into his apartment. And somewhere outside, they wanted to force things on him. And he says, that's the Shita Habduka. That is how the extremists operate. They come with lots of people to pressure. And you have to be very strong to stand up about them. And then he says that tonight, Dalit Shvat, this is the Yortzeit of Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg. He says, I was not worthy to know him personally, but I tried to learn from his great soul and from his ideas. I owe him a lot. 35 years ago, I took upon myself editing the journal Hamayan. Rabbi Weinberg wrote me a letter and wished me long life for Hamayan. And b'zchut this bracha, we've gone on 35 years in our own approach without, being without attacks from the right or the left. And that's, I went a little faster, but I wanted to finish the book. Although we have one more week, but we are now here. I'm going to show you something here. We began, hold on a second. I'm going to pull something up for you here. This will take us back. Where are we here? No. Hold on. Here it is. Okay. So this will bring back some memories for those of you who've... Okay, so here I'm going to pull up for you, show you a screen. We began study of this book, May 18th, 2020. And you can see, look, you got it has over 2,000 views. As Rabbi Kelman mentioned last week, it was because we were all inside and I couldn't go to the library to get my books. I order when I do in the Gedolim, they send me interlibrary loan and we couldn't do that. So I decided to do this. It's been a long run and I'm especially grateful to all of you who've been here each and every week with all the questions and all the comments and it's a real achievement. I do still have one more week though. Because I want to talk one week, I'll give you a few examples and letters that were not included in the book, including from at least one or two, well, especially one rabbi. And we'll get into Neturei Karta. Wait till you see what I have from Neturei Karta, Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport, something else maybe dealing with Chabad. So I want to do one class, it'll be next week, on what I did include in the book and why I didn't include it. And maybe I should have included it. You can disagree, but before I get to the questions, I just want to say, and I thank Rabbi Kelman. He's never had a class for 51, it'll be 52. It's a long series. I already told you my wife thought I was crazy, but it turned out it worked. And we discussed everything. We dealt with halacha, we dealt with hashkafa, we dealt with history, we dealt with everything under the sun over the last year. I'm looking at Susanna. She's right on my screen. All sorts of grammar things. So thank you, Susanna, for your comments. I don't know if other than you and me and David Eisen, I don't know if anyone cared, but I enjoyed it. And we really did a lot. And I appreciate, as it says in was it Pirkei Avos, me Tamida Yoter Mikulam. I learned so much from all the people sending in the emails and the questions and the comments. So it was a great run. And I thank you. And we, like I said, we'll have one more class where we'll do, and for all of you who are not listening live, listening either on the Torah in Motion or watching on the YouTube, thank you as well. And we will have one more class with, as I said, the stuff which wasn't included. So let me take the question, but I thought I should say this because now we finished the book, went through 371 pages, the last two pages, last three, three pages are just the names of the people and who they, what books they wrote. It was something.
Thank you. I want to express my thank you. I appreciate it. I think it was a great, way to make use of the time when we were stuck and even when we're not stuck, but this was the impetus. And Yashikov, this is not just 51 weeks. This is really for 10 years we've been learning here. More than 10 years. I highly recommend many of going back all the years of the Gedolei Yisrael we have discussed. They're great rabbinic figures and from, you know, like in the book, totally across the spectrum, really fascinating talks, dating back over 10 years. But I don't know exactly how many we have on the website, close to 200?
No, about 270 now.
Or 270, right up. Oh my gosh, wow. Not including this, of course. And then we're going to continue. This was the 1 year delay till we get to Shaul Lieberman. We did the Netziv recently and the Aruch HaShulchan and Rav Yitzchak Kochan and Rav Aaron Cutler. Those are some of the recent people we've done. But we've done everybody from German Orthodoxy, Hungarian Orthodoxy, in the Hasidic world, Hungarian world. So it's well worth listening to. You can't watch them. You can only listen to them, but they're all on the website. You can go take a look. And thank you very much. And now we can get to all the questions.
Questions, yes, we should do. If we could get together in Canada, we could do a see him. Baruch says, did he send you volume 1, 2? I'm not sure which, who you're referring to. You have to text me again. And Baruch says, seems stealing the ball and basketball can be a foul in some cases. Well, yes, if you injure the person, if you push him. But if I'm holding the ball here and a guy grabs it and then we're fighting over it, oh, Gershon's correct. You're right. Thank you. Jakubowicz came from Königsberg. Then the family moved to Berlin. And that's where Kant lived. But still, that's still strange to name him after Kant. But Kant was a significant figure. I asked Professor Breuer, his father's Isaac Breuer. Isaac Breuer had two pictures on his wall. He had one was of Kant and the other was of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And I asked Professor Breuer after the war, did your father, because his father lived, I think, to 46. Did your father ever take down the picture of Kant? And he said, no. His father, too, had this idea of the other Germany, that there were two Germanys, the good Germany, the Kantian Germany of Kant and Schiller and all that. And then there was the other Germany. But to name someone, Isaac Breuer thought you can't understand Judaism in modern times without understanding Kant. So if Jakubowicz's father also thought that, I get it. Because remember, this is the non-Jewish name. In Germany, you had two names. You had the Jewish name and the non-Jewish name. So you have the rabbi, Samson and Shamshon, I guess it's one. But the other rabbi in Frankfurt, Matei Levi, Mordechai the Hebrew, Marcus, even Hildesheimer, Israel, his non-Jewish name. But they have these non-Jewish names also. Paul, as we said, and Pinchas. Yes, and I met Rabbi Jakubowicz's brother once in Toronto. No, Scranton, the University of Scranton, it's a Catholic university, so no pro-choice groups, for instance, are chartered. And they say that a pro-choice politician can't speak. Biden was supposed to go to Notre Dame, and there was a pushback on it. What we do have, and what YU, I guess, could have, is that you can't have a club at the University of Scranton, let's say a gay club, which advocates for gay marriage, all that, that's against Catholic teaching. But they do have a club, and this is a Catholic university, the idea being that gay students, Catholic gay students, have troubles, have difficulty. They feel they need companionship. They feel left out, support, that sort of thing. And that is allowed at my university, Catholic University, and I assume it's allowed at pretty much all the Catholic universities. And that's what the students are asking for at YU. They're very clear. They're not asking for anything to change halacha. They're simply asking for a place where they can be recognized who they are. And the response is, well, would you have a club for the Mechalei Shabbos to be proud you're Mechalei Shabbos, to be proud you're an adulterer? And their response is, this has nothing to do with sexual relations. This is just who we are. So this is, and YU, they've allowed these speeches, and they had a whole panel with Rabbi Blau on it. And then, of course, you had Rabbi Tursky and someone else, one of the other rabbis, strongly attack it. So even in YU, they're not clear what to do about this. The head of the YU Rabbinical School, Rabbi Penner, he gave an interview just a few months ago. I can talk about it. I knew about this actually before. His sons were in my brother's classes, by the way, in yeshiva. But in high school, but I can talk about it now because it's open. I want to mention it otherwise. He gave a whole thing. You can find it online. His son came out. His son is now starting to be a chazan at the seminary. He didn't ask him in the interview, would you go to your son's graduation of chazanas? But he speaks about, his son is married to a man, and he speaks about what it is, you know, him coming to terms, loving his son, never stopping loving his son, but coming to terms as an Orthodox rabbi, and he's not just an Orthodox rabbi, he's the head of the rabbinical school, of the most important rabbinical school in America, and I have a lot of admiration that Rabbi Penner was willing to speak about it, and it's, if you haven't heard it, to listen to Rabbi Penner, his discussions, maybe something for Torah in Motion also, of what he learned, because he knew nothing about it, and his attitude was like everyone else, that first of all, this can't be, and, you know, it's, especially you can imagine in his position, it's such a sensitive discussion with him and his son together. It's with David Bashefkin. You can listen to it. And so this is an issue which is coming into our communities, into our homes. Rabbi Kelman was thinking ahead of this before it was in the meeting. You can go on the website and he has, there's a whole thing they did there, a panel discussion. Rabbi Rapport, I don't know if that's online.
Popular, it's our most listened to event by far ever. With Rabbi Rappaport and Steve Greenberg and a kid who was Orthodox and gay and psychiatrist, fascinating. Then we did a few months later, four kids in their 20s, four Orthodox or formerly Orthodox. One's actually a Baltruva, kids who are gay. And what can I say? It is a real issue. And if I can mention, you know, I watched recently, Rabbi Greenberg sent me, I think they're doing a showing. I don't think it's available. Unbelievably powerful film they put out in Israel. I think the Rav of Rutz Zurim in Gush Etzion. It's about couples, Orthodox couples who one of the couples was gay and they got married. Their rabbi's like, Mary, you know, you'll get over it. And the spouse didn't know. And when they got married, and it's really, it's painful to watch what happened to these, you know, couples. Anyways, it's, I just mentioned.
Well, we're at the beginnings of this issue, and we'll have to see what the post game and what the religious leaders. Rav Lichtenstein also gave an interview on this. If you haven't seen the interview, I highly recommend it, in which he speaks about, you know, the obviously this halacha, but the sense of revulsion, which is found in the sources. But Rav Lichtenstein's approach is that, you know, he wasn't in tune with this sort of revulsion that people have towards gays. And I don't know where this is all going to end up. Halacha is going to remain the same, but in terms of attitudinal, where it's going to be. iPad asks me, I go by Professor Mark. Well, so does Dr. Lamb did, and Professor Berger, and Professor Schatz, because when your main parnasa is being a professor of, or Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, when your main parnasa and your main activities is let's say history or economics or whatever it is, that's what you go by. But Rabbi Jacobovitz, his main thing was being the rabbi, not serving in the House of Lords. So that's why. Mark says, is Yeshiva University secularity similar to Brandeis? Exactly. Yeshiva University is no different. A non-Jew who applies to Yeshiva University has to be accepted. I mean, if his grades are good enough, you can't reject him based on the fact that he's not Jewish. What you can say is you can say, you have to, you know Hebrew? Well, you have to know Hebrew to come in or something, which I don't think you do. But so that would be a lawsuit. But a non-Jew can apply. Why you professors get discounts on the tuition. So someone told me from YU that, so I asked him, someone who works there, what are the YU professors do who aren't Jewish? They don't want to send their kids to YU. He says, well, he said that he knows that one of them, their university paid for his son to go to another school, which is what he wanted anyway. He's not Jewish. Yes, or it wasn't religious. So I don't know if he was Jewish. He doesn't want his kid going to YU. So but Yeshiva University is a secular university. But you have to take Jewish subjects there. The yeshiva program or the other programs, just like any university. Brandeis University is a secular university. If Brandeis University wanted to require everyone to learn Chinese, they're allowed to. But you can't discriminate as a secular university. Yeah, that's the thing. So we'll see where this goes. I don't know if Nat Lewin will have to weigh in on this. The other day he said he couldn't type it in the chat. It was too long, but he emailed me a long email about the issue in Long Island. And he doesn't think that the VOD has a leg to stand on. He thinks that, you know, if an individual rabbi wants to open up a Mahadran Hashkacha, Rabbi Kelman, there's debate in halakhic literature of whether you can prevent someone from publishing Torah. Some argues it belongs to the Jewish people. Yeah, the controversy over the letters. I went to Professor Hyman by before that, and he said, we don't censor Gadol Yisrael. The issue was that people thought that he spoke about the Haredi world in certain ways. They wouldn't want it to be public. And also he wrote about these halachot that we have to, you know, maybe update certain halachot. Rabbi Berger, Professor Berger, said it was very important these letters were published because it shows that you can have these questions and these doubts that Rabbi Weinberg has, but he doesn't throw out the Torah. He recognizes we live with these doubts. The letters are important, no question about it. Rabbi Weingart, who's the last student of Rabbi Weinberg in Switzerland, Rav Avraham Abba Weingart, he's a good friend of mine. He very much wanted to take my son out to lunch on Friday, last Friday. My son's on the plane right now, but on Friday he went with him. He wrote the letter to the Torah Moda Journal. If you read it, this whole controversy then led to J.J. Schachter publishing his famous article, Facing the Truths of History. But Rabbi Weingart wrote a letter full of pathos why he opposed publishing this letter. And I have long, long letters from him. His attitude, it wasn't that the stuff he said about the, you know, the halacha, he questions, you know, what to do about these halachot. And it wasn't even about the criticism of the Haredi world per se. He says you can write about that. He says that when you see the letters, one after the other, just criticism of the Haredim, it creates a misconception. You look at Rabbi Weinberg like he's somewhat crank, you know, who was obsessed with the Haredim, when it's not true. He's writing to Atlas. So Atlas is outside the Orthodox world. So there he can complain about the Haredim. When he writes to Rabbi Yechezkel Sarada, the Rosh Yeshiva Chevron, he's complaining about the Mizrahi people. I mean, that's how he was. So Rabbi Weingart is correct that when you read these letters one after the other, you could get a sense that's not really in line with who he was. He didn't go through his life, you know, as one of these people attacking the Haredim. On the other hand, I tried to put it into context. Those are the letters. I published other letters where you see other things. Mel says, I've seen Goldhagen participate in discussion panels in the last few years. It says he resigned from Harvard in 2003 to focus on writing. Well, he was told he wasn't going to get tenure. So that's why, he did write. He wrote a few books, really achieved any renown. The book on the Catholic Church, he's like declaring that the Catholics have to completely revise their teachings, and we're going to tell them what to do. The exact sort of thing that David Berger, who again, I'll come back to him, said that it's a very chutzpahdik thing to do. We don't want the non-Jews, or Soloveitchik said this, this is why he was so didn't want to get involved in interreligious dialogue. We don't want to have the quid pro quo. The non-Jews start revising their theology, and now we're supposed to revise our theology. Oh, Rabbi Rossman. Rabbi Rossman. I don't know why you're asking, Baruch, but yes, he sent me the first volume also with a very nice inscription. I'd buy the book. I'd love to buy the book. Everyone should get the book. It's a very nice sefer, but if someone wants to send it to me, he listens. I don't know if he's listening now, but for many years he listened to Torah in Motion. And it's a big zechus that Torah in Motion would have some Machaber Sforim, like Rabbi Yonason Rossman. A Flatbush graduate, as I recall, but was someone who then went to study many years yeshiva in Israel and a very, very big Talmud Chacham. So I consider it a zechus in particular. It's a zechus to all the people who listen to us, but a double zechus, some of the Mechaberei Sfarim and the big Talmud Chachamim who listen to us as well. Baruch is, if you strike the offensive player with an arm or leg. Okay. Well, you know, that's different. Had Rabbi Lior said, if in stealing the ball, you, I guess, but he doesn't say that. He says you're not allowed to steal the ball. Maybe he misunderstood, or maybe he didn't express himself. Let's assume that Rabbi Lior was saying you have to steal the ball in a kosher way, but if you steal it in a non-kosher way. Estella, Monday nights will not be the same without this class. Well, but I'll be back. different class, but we have one more week. Justin says, Goldhagen, and thank you, Justin, very much for less about the telling me about Rabbi Pollack and the Lost Train. Goldhagen was at his book.
You're welcome.
Was a rock star in Germany. He lectured in German. Yes, they would come. And what was ironic is that many of the young Germans in particular, if you've been to Germany, you know the young Germans, many of them, they're very young people are countercultural and they're against the ideals of the next generation before them. But it didn't, I have to say that at the end of the day, Professor Matt Goldish once asked me, we were speaking about Goldhagen, and I said, wow, to write a book like that. And he said to me, well, would you really want to have written that? I said, well, why not? He says, because the academic world, your peers, have panned it. So here you have something where you're a rock star, a superstar, traveling all over the world, making lots of money. And yet your peers, the ones who at the end of the day really matter, they're all panning it. So in retrospect, I think that probably Professor Goldish, Matt Goldish, if you don't know the name, he's written on Sabbateanism and lots of good stuff, Isaac Newton and the Jews. I think in the end, and I should be more interested in my peers. And so I think I generally would assume that Browning and Yehuda Bauer and Goldhagen, and not Goldhagen, and Hilberg and the rest are correct, and that Goldhagen is not. Yes, no, Rabbi Penner is not one of the Gedolim. He's an administrator. But in the talk, he says that he wouldn't even say who he spoke to. He says that he called up some of the big rabbis. He didn't know what to do. Obviously, even to speak in this interview, he called them, and he was very surprised at some of the psakim he was given. You can be sure he was speaking to Rabbi Wilger of Schechter or someone like that. And the fact that he would agree to speak about this, I don't think this would have happened 10 years ago. And yet, yes, he's not... you say that Gedolim and Rav Shechter don't agree with what he said. I do not believe that. I don't know if you're correct on that. If you listen to the interview, Baruch, he didn't say anything. He wasn't charting new ground. He's not a posse, go to Israel. He simply was talking about the experience of having a son, a child, who is gay, and how he, in his life, had to learn to accept this. He doesn't approve of, he obviously doesn't approve of a son being married. He doesn't, but how he had to accept this, how he had to deal with it, the struggles, the therapy, and how at the end of the day, the message is, but your children, you love your children no matter what. And that's what he spoke about. That's all he was trying to, and to, that's why I think, I don't know. Next time I see him, now we're having in New York, in New Jersey, we now can have shiurim. And so when Rav Shechter comes, I'll ask him to drive him home, and hopefully he won't get in a flat tire. And but I have to tell you, Baruch, if I ask him, this is something that it's a private thing. You don't share it. So unless he said it. So I don't know. I'll leave it at that. I just found it of interest, and we'll see what happens with YU. And it's only going to happen with YU, because I saw someone in the Haredi world attack Penner, and they say, we don't have these problems at the yeshivas. So we know that in the Haredi yeshivas, they don't have any gays. It's like in Iran. There's no such thing as homosexuality in the Haredi yeshivas. So it's only going to happen at YU. So we will see. Well, thank you very much for staying on with me.
Thank you. By the way, it was interesting. He says in the interview that when his son got married, he asked four different rabbanim what to do, and he got four different answers. He didn't say what the answers were, and he didn't say what he did, but he said four different, it's hard to know what four different answers are. Yes, no, go for the, not the chuppah, the meal. Like, I'm not sure what the fourth answer was. You know, I got to figure out, but that was, it's a tough issue, as you said.
And remember, it's a different question often between your family. Psakim are also often given 100%. For family that are different. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg said to a man whose son intermarried that he thought it was probably best for him to go to the wedding so that he would not then lose touch with his son and maybe be able to convince the wife to convert. He would never have said that to someone else, go to an intermarriage, but with the father and the child, where it would have led to a complete break. So we all know that different rulings are given for different situations. So.
I quoted you on that often, by the way, in my shurim, that what you quoted in the name of the Sri of the Age, that I don't think it's in print in the Sri of the Age.
He said, no, but it was printed in Yateid Neman, believe it or not. He said that he's not sure, but he thinks it probably should. You know, he wasn't 100% sure, but he said that it probably is a good idea, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to next week. What didn't make the book? That's 51 weeks and only 1 week, I think, what didn't make the book. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Rachel Sharansky-Danziger, part two of her series on storytelling and the rise of kings. I think it was a fascinating shiur last week. Everybody's invited. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. And then at 1 p.m., we're having a special interview. My brother, who runs a student organization in Israel, Ketma, will be interviewing Shira Mervis, who was just appointed the Rosh Kehillah. I'm not sure the exact terminology. Rabbanit Shira Mervis is the first spiritual leader, a woman of an Orthodox congregation. So she's graduating now at Lindenbaum. And so that'll be at 1 p.m. p.m. tomorrow. So everybody's invited. That's a separate login for that.
That's the one we spoke about. That's the one we spoke about a few weeks ago.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. You mentioned.
Well, looking forward to that. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's should be very interesting. I spoke to her briefly today for the first time. I mean, her English is quite. It'll be in English. I mean, she's Israeli. She is Israeli. She spent a couple years on Shlichut in L.A. Everybody's welcome. That's tomorrow at 1. So we have 11 and 1, and then our Shirim on Wednesday. We look forward to learning you during the week. And, okay, everybody, we will invite your friends to join us. Yes, part 1 was outstanding. Thank you, Mel.
The separate login, Joel, was sent out.
I'll send it. Basically, you should the best way to get it is to register, and then I'll send the login tomorrow. Those who've registered for all the classes, I'll send you. It'll be part of the login. But I can tell you now, instead of typing in summer as the password, it's Efrat. That's where the shul is.
Just go to the website and you can register.
But it takes 10 seconds to register. Just, you know, you should be automatic once you've done. But I'll send it out by email, everybody, before, but that's what it's going to say. Okay. Laila Tov, thank you again, Dr. Shapiro, for 51 fascinating weeks. And we'll please go out, see you next week. And by next week, actually, I think restaurant patios might be open for 4 people. That's about the extent that we're going. So we're getting there. Slowly, we're getting there. Anyways, okay, Laila to everybody. Be well.
What about the letter from the Netziv?
I assume Dr. Shapiro will talk about it next week. I don't know. And again, I want to thank make mention that all the learning today to our motion website and MP3s and Shiurim is dedicated to the honor and memory of Rabbi Bernard Mandelbaum, Harav David Ben Yaakov Yisrael, on his 20th yahrzeit. Yizichro Baruch. Okay, everybody be well and Laila Tov.